Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for February's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, European veterinary specialist in small animal oncology, Irina Gramer. Thank you, Irina. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello everyone. Thanks, Simi Joe, for the nice introduction. I would like to just welcome you all to this seminar today on canine multiple myeloma in first opinion practice and what you can do in the practice to treat multiple myeloma patients. So throughout the presentation, I will try to explain diagnostic tools that we have to diagnose those patients. And also explain a few different treatment options. As Semi Jo's already said to you, please feel free to ask questions throughout the presentation or at the end of it, and I will then try to read them out, and then we can try and answer them together. I'd like to start my presentation today by introducing a case of mine that I've had a few years ago that will make the session a little bit more practical at the beginning. And I always find it's a bit easier to learn if we actually have a case example. Our little friend here, Buster, today will introduce some very important clinical signs to us. And give us some ideas for working up a myeloma patient. So, as I said, this is Buster. He is a 9-year-old male-neutered crossbreed. And he presented as an emergency for bleeding from a subcutaneous mass that was taken off surgically. He also, following a conversation with the owner, appears to have been a bit more lethargic for a few weeks. He's had intermittent epistaxis, although that's not evident at presentation. He's also possibly PUPD and has had a bit of a stiff gait where the owners thought it's an older dog, this could just be some arthritic changes. So on our physical examination now, we find that Buster is actually tachycardic. So his heart rate is about 134 beats per minute. He's also uncomfortable between the area of T3 and L3. And obviously he's got the bleeding surgical side. That's what he's been referred for. So I started off this case after the physical examination with some blood tests, because obviously I want to assess why is the dog bleeding. I want to evaluate causes for the possible PUPD here, and also for the dog's tachycardia. So I started off with a hematology, and you can see that we've got changes in hemoglobin. So that's just mildly reduced and hasn't actually led to any changes in hematocrit. So that might be that our bleeding is too acute and we don't see any changes, or it's just a minor bleeding. Then we also have got thrombocytopenia in Buster's case. And we can also see that the reticulocyte count is increased. So this could be a sign of regeneration, obviously. We know the dog has had intermittent epistaxis, so that is very likely why the reticulocyte count is high. As a next one, I've done the serum biochemistry, and what we can see here is that the total proteins in Buster's case are elevated. And now, looking at the albumin and globulin levels, we've got a raised globulin. The other thing that was reported in the history is PUPD. So we're very likely going to check our total calcium here, which is normal. What I always tend to do, though, and there are cases with hypercalcemia where we can only see this elevation in the ionized calcium, which is the case here. So I would definitely advice in PUPD patients to check the ionized calcium levels before starting investigations for example, hyperadrenocorticism. And indeed, here we actually managed to prove that this dog is hypercalcemic. One thing that has not been done here is a coagulation profile. So that has been missed or was simply not done in that emergency situation. Obviously, if you've got a bleeding dog with reported epistaxis, it would be worthwhile doing that to check the PT and APTT to, for example, rule out rat poisoning and potentially even do a buccal mucosal bleeding time to differentiate, are we dealing with a primary or a secondary coagulation cascade issue. So what is now our problem list for Buster? So just summarizing what we've got here. And at this point, I just want to briefly go through possible differentials that we would probably generally have in our minds when going through this case. So the first one is bleeding from that subcutaneous mass. So this could indeed be a problem with the coagulation cascade, which, to be fair, we have not assessed here. The dog could have some form of thrombocytopathy or could be thrombocytopenic, which we know in this case this dog is, although I don't consider a value of 82 low enough to cause spontaneous bleeding. Another option is that the bleeding or a possible thrombocytopathy is caused by a neoplasm and is therefore paraneoplastic. The next problem in Buster's case is the epistaxis. So that is, from a differential point of view, very similar to the bleeding above. But we also need to consider intranasal disease, such as a foreign body, neoplastic disease, or some infectious agents. The next one is lethargy. Lethargy, I don't want to go into too much detail. It's quite an unspecific clinical sign and can just be associated with any systemic illness. We've also noticed on clinical examination that the dog's painful. Yes, we've got an older dog, so this could just be spondylosis, some form of spinal disease, there could be a chronic disc. Again, neoplasia is a possibility with, for example, bone lesions. Then we also know the dog's tachycardic. What is the possibility here is that the dog's simply painful. We've found pain between T3, L3, that is a possibility. It could also be due to blood loss. We know the dog's bleeding. Other causes might be primary heart or lung disease, although our auscultation wasn't suggestive of that. Then we've got hyperglobulinemia, which really only has two differentials, one being infectious diseases and the other ones being neoplastic. Then we've got hypercalcemia. Again, this could be a paraneoplastic change. And the most common tumor types to cause that is probably the anal sac adenocarcinoma, T-cell lymphomas, and myeloma. Other causes for hypercalcemia are possible, but I won't mention those just now. And then last but not least, the dog's thrombocytopenic. So this could be due to loss. The dog has been bleeding. Decreased development, in which case the bone marrow probably has the issue. Or it could be destruction, so that the cells are destroyed due to an immune-mediated disease. So what I just wanted to show you here is, in comparison to the problem list that we have established for Buster, what are the diagnostic criteria to make a diagnosis for multiple myeloma? So you can see there are quite a few on that list, starting off with bone marrow plasmacytosis. That's probably your most important diagnostic tool and factor here. So in order to make the diagnosis, we want a plasmacytosis with over 20% of plasma cells in the bone marrow. We also can find osteolytic lesions really anywhere in the dog's body. We're also looking for serum or urine myeloma proteins. And then there are CBC abnormalities. So that could just be a single cytopenia. It could be as far as a pancytopenia. That is really individual. Proteinuria occurs regularly. Dogs can be acetemic with multiple myeloma, or as we've seen, hypercalcemic. Now, if we go to Buster's case, we've already identified two criteria, and I'm stating above here that we want, ideally, five criteria to make our diagnosis of multiple myeloma. So at the moment, we've only identified a CBC abnormality, and we've got hypercalcemia. So we're not quite there yet to actually say that Buster has multiple myeloma. So what else can we do now to prove the multiple myeloma here? So one very easy way of dealing with this is to send off a serum sample for a serum electrophoresis. The reason I'm saying that's simple is you've probably already taken bloods of this dog, and then you can just send the rest that you've got, so to speak, off to a lab. So the one on the left here shows you a healthy patient, where you would see for the electrophoresis, you've got an albumin peak, and then all your other proteins are kind of you can nearly not see them in the graph. If then, in comparison to that, we look at an electrophoresis of a dog with multiple myeloma, for example, then we can see a very high peak of the gamma proteins here, and that is what the peak would look like for a monoclonal gammopathy. So before we can now conclude that we've done these serum electrophoresis, the dog must have multiple myeloma with monoclonal gammopathy, we just need to take one step back and ask ourselves, are there any other differentials that can cause this picture? And indeed there are. So any lymphoreticular tumor can cause this monoclonal gammopathy. So any B-cell lymphoma, extramedullary plasmacytoma, or leukemia forms can cause this. Also, not to forget, chronic infections can cause this peak. So what you can do is, a very simple way is ask for a travel history in your history taking. The other way is to obviously take more bloods of the dog to exclude them definitively. And then as a last differential, we have this here that's called monoclonal gammopathy of unknown significance. That is essentially a diagnosis of exclusion. Then another possible diagnostic tool is to perform a urinalysis and electrophoresis on this. So for once, we want to do the urinalysis to assess kidney function, because due to multiple myeloma causing hyperviscosity syndrome, or the dog being hypercalcemic, it can cause kidney damage. And then we want to make sure how severe that might be. So that was done in Buster's case here. That is his urinalysis. The only surprise a little bit here is that his USG is quite high, which I wouldn't necessarily expect in a dog that is PUPD. So it could just be that the dog is dehydrated, and that's why that is falsely elevated. Another finding is we've got protein 4+ on our dipstick, and that's not falsely elevated due to blood, because blood is negative. That's further confirmed by the increased UPCR. So this dog indeed has proteinuria. If we see this kind of urinalysis, you then have the option to send the urine also off for an electrophoresis, and you would get a picture like this down here. So just for comparison again, this one is a healthy patient where you just see kind of almost a straight line. That's the albumin. And then for the myeloma patient, or where we've got these Benz-Jones proteins in the urine, you can see a peak again in this gamma area, if you remember how the electrophoresis for serum has looked before. Now, before we go further, let's review again the diagnostic criteria list. And we've now got two more findings that we connect to Buster's problem list. One being that we did find a monoclonal gammopathy. So there must be these proteins in circulation and in the urine that we can find them. And we've also identified proteinuria. So that gives us four out of the necessary five criteria. So we need to look a bit further to actually make our diagnosis. So the next diagnostic tool that we have available is diagnostic imaging. And this, I understand, will be very different for each one of you and dependent on what you have available in practice. So I assume that the majority of you probably has access to x-rays and probably an ultrasound machine. So that is probably what's most commonly done in first opinion practice. If you have the option to send for a CT scan or you decide at this point to refer, then the CT scan is probably what's going to be done. One thing I just want to mention here as well, when you do survey radiographs, if that's what you decide to do, then include thorax, abdomen, and that will give you a nice overview along the vertebrae. You've probably got a pelvis in there, so there's a lot of bony structures you can assess. And when you do the abdominal ultrasound, I would always advise to take FNAs of spleen and liver, although they might look completely normal. Purely because a lot of multiple myeloma patients are diagnosed purely based on FNAs from those two organs, and then you may not have to do the bone marrow aspiration. As I said, CT scan, again, that would include thorax and abdomen, and that will include a lot of the bones again to check for osteolytic lesions. So over the next slides, I've just kind of want to present a few examples of radiographs and also a CT scan. So for the ones of you that may not have seen a multiple myeloma patient, that can take a look what these lesions might look like. So this one here is obviously a spine radiograph in the area here of the thoracic going over to the lumbar region. And as the arrow points out here, and you compare this process with the one to the left and right, you can see there is a very obvious osteolytic lesion in the center. The next radiograph is an image of a femur and a tibia. And you can see where the arrows are pointing. That's where our osteolytic lesions are. And that is quite a typical appearance for multiple myeloma. So the ones of you that have seen maybe x-rays of an osteosarcoma lesion or a bone metastasis, they look very different. So those lesions, they look very irregular. They're not just lytic, they're also productive. Whereas these myeloma lesions, typically they look as if someone had taken a biopsy out of the bone. This is an image of a pelvis. So again, similar as with the femur before, a nice and round, very smooth edges, osteolytic lesion here. This one here now is a CT scan. Just to point out what the CT images in comparison to radiographs can show. So a CT scan is always more sensitive to pick up smaller lesions for once, but to also assess vertebral lesions with in a lot more detail. So whereas on radiographs we're probably more able to see problems in the processes, the CT will be able to assess the body more accurately, and we probably would have missed that there are three, maybe four lesions here, so the CT is a lot more sensitive. So there are a few more images coming now. So this one here where the arrow is pointing, you can see that is that lytic, it's kind of potentially invading the spinal cord and could cause compression there. And this one is a very horrible picture. It's very caudal in the dog towards the hips. We've got the body of the vertebrae affected. We've got the pelvic bones affected. So you can probably understand a dog with these kind of lesions will be very, very painful. So I've already mentioned bone marrow aspiration as a diagnostic tool, and it probably is our most important and valuable diagnostic tool to make the diagnosis. So what the picture here is showing is on the skeleton where your entrance points are. This one here is an example for the humerus. There are, however, other sites where you can take a bone marrow aspirate. So sites are the tohunter, where you can take its back leg. You can go to the humerus. You can take them out of the ischium. You can go to the sternum and ribs. So some people do them there. It doesn't really matter where you take your sample, as long as you are confident with it. And I guess confidence is very much dependent on where you trained to do a bone marrow sample. So my preferred site is the humerus, that is shown in the pictures here. Although you should be prepared to potentially change the location. So the only reason for that, for example, is let's say you've done survey radiographs and you can see the scapula, the humerus, and you can assess the femur, and you find there are no obvious osteolytic lesions in the humerus area, but there are lots of them in the back leg area, in which case I'd say, although you might prefer doing them at the humerus, try to go for the tohunter, because your chances of getting a diagnostic sample are going to be much higher if you go to the area where you can see osteolytic lesions. So this is now a slide showing you the procedure for the bone marrow aspiration. So I'm not sure if anyone of you is familiar with the technique or has done it before. Therefore, I have just included it in the presentation for the ones that want to get started in doing it. So what we start with is, obviously, we've got the dog prepped here as sterile as possible, and then we're using a Jamshidi needle to withdraw the bone marrow. So first is your place your needle, and then it says here, assure that the needle is in place. So how can you do that? So what I tend to do is I lock my needle into the bone, and you will feel whether you are in the bone or not. And then I let go of the leg that I'm kind of holding to support my procedure, and just wiggle around on the Jamshidi needle, and what should be happening is that the entire leg is moving as you move your Jamshidi needle, and then you can be relatively certain that your needle is in place. Then obviously you want to withdraw some bone marrow, and generally if you've got a dog that is over 15 kilos, I tend to take 1.5 to 2 mils of bone marrow. If it's a smaller dog, then maybe just take about a mil. Always prepare the syringe you're taking the bone marrow with an anticoagulant, because otherwise your whole procedure would have been for nothing. That bone marrow aspirate, you can obviously send for cytology now. You can also, and I would always advise to do so, to try and get a core biopsy after you've done your aspiration. And then I tend to place the dog on a pain medication afterwards. So what we know from people is that the placement of the needle is not the most painful thing, but what is the withdrawal of the bone marrow. So this here now is an example of a cytology for a multiple myeloma case. And although you won't or unlikely to get this picture, you will get a report. I just wanted to show you what those what a bone marrow looks like with multiple myeloma. So if you have a look at this picture on the left here, what you can see is cells that kind of look similar to one another, and that you don't actually see many other cells. So there are very occasional little lymphocytes in here, but they are certainly not making up the majority. Whereas in a usual bone marrow, you're expecting a variety of different looking cells. So the majority you've got in here are these ones here that you will probably all agree they look like plasma cells, especially if you go over to the right picture, you've got them a bit bigger. These ones here, that is the classic appearance of plasma cells. So you've got a round cell, a very basophilic cytoplasm, and an eccentric nucleus. So that's the key features of plasma cells. If you now look around, those two guys, they're quite big. And then you've got cells that got same features, but they're smaller. And then you've got one that's not even round anymore, that's a bit elongated. So those are malignancy criteria. So you can tell by looking at this picture, there are plasma cells, but they don't look alike. So obviously there must be something neoplastic going on to cause this kind of picture. So this is much more like what you're going to get. So that's the report for our BUSTA case here, actually. So what you're obviously looking out for is you want the pathologist to say, yes, they've found plasma cells. That's what you were after. Then something to just confirm that. So basophilic cytoplasm is something they might say. They might say eccentric nucleus. So those features you want to see. And then what you definitely want is you want them to give you the percentage of those atypical plasma cells of the overall cell harvest. And in our case here, in Buster's case, that was 85 to 90%. So that is a huge number of plasma cells in that bone marrow. So that's way over the 20% that we use as cutoff for the diagnosis. So if the pathologist does not give you that percentage, then you should ring up and ask them for it. So I just want to mention this as well as a diagnostic tool. This is the kind of molecular diagnostic tools, although you are probably not very likely to need them. In some cases, however, the plasma cells, they look so atypical that the clinical pathologist won't be able to give you 100% the diagnosis, in which case you could perform a PAR, which stands for PCR for antigen receptor rearrangement. So you might be familiar with this test for lymphoma cases. And that's exactly why you want to use it here, because that is your main other differential usually, lymphoma. Another possibility, what you could use is an immunohistoimmunocytochemistry for MUM1. So that is an antibody that is very specific for plasma cells. So in case of a lymphoma, that MUM1 wouldn't be positive. So that is a very good test to differentiate a multiple myeloma from, for example, the plasmacytoid form of a lymphoma, which can look very similar. So going back to our diagnostic criteria list, you can see now we've got a lot more bold letters here. We've got the bone marrow plasmacytosis, we've got osteolytic lesions, we've got the myeloma proteins, we've got thrombocytopenia, proteinuria, and high calcium levels. So all this together, we can now confidently say that BUSTA has been diagnosed with multiple myeloma. So over the next slides, I just want to take a bit of a step back, because we've now heard a lot about diagnostics that we can do for multiple myeloma patients. And now I just want to talk a little bit about the pathology and the behavior of multiple myeloma. So plasma cells essentially are a type of white blood cell. And if we look at white blood cells, there are obviously lymphocytes come to mind. There are also monocytes, for example. And for lymphocytes, we differentiate the T cell from the B cell. And that's where our plasma cells are coming from. So essentially, a plasma cell is a mature B cell that is producing antibodies. So these antibodies, we will see shortly, are responsible for a lot of clinical signs that we can see in multiple myeloma. So plasma cells, atypical ones, can cause multiple myeloma. We know that. But I also want to briefly mention those other three diseases here, which you may or may not have encountered, because the picture, the cytological picture, will be very similar. So the first one would be the extramedullary plasmacytoma, which is generally a more benign form, and you will usually encounter as a cutaneous or an oral mass, and generally surgery for those is enough. Sometimes there can be multiple cutaneous lumps, in which case you need to consider chemotherapy. There is also a more aggressive form of extramedullary plasmacytoma, which occurs in the GI tract, and is then generally a lot more aggressive and requires chemo. Then the next one is the IgM macroglobulinemia, which is a very, very rare disease, and you will very likely never encounter, but it's very similar to multiple myeloma, and the produced antibodies, the immunoglobulins, are IgM, as the name says. Then last but not least, we've got the solitary osseous plasmacytoma, which is again very, very rare, and often, very often progresses to the systemic form, the multiple myeloma, and then requires the same treatment. So this slide here shows, we've just talked about those antibodies, so which are the immunoglobulins, so that's the so-called M component, of that disease. So we differentiate different immunoglobulins that we can encounter. So those three we're probably all familiar with. Then we've got the light chains, which are also referred to as the Benz-Jones proteins. So those are the ones we find in urine, because they're small enough to cross the tubules in the kidney, and then we can find them in the urine. And then there are heavy chains, which we generally won't find in the urine because they're too big. So I've just put a little circle around the IgA and IgG here, because that is probably the most typical myeloma forms that we can encounter in dogs. And I want to make you aware at this point here that sometimes, based on clinical signs, and we may already have a bone marrow aspirate saying this dog has multiple myeloma, but we don't see the typical hyperglobulinemia or high total proteins that we would usually want to see. And the reason for that is very likely that this dog has a multiple myeloma producing the IgA component, and they are often too small a protein to make a big difference in the total protein count. So if you encounter that, then don't be discouraged that you probably got the wrong diagnosis. You're probably just dealing with an IgA component here. So as next ones, we've got the possible clinical signs that we might encounter in multiple myeloma. And Buster has already helped us a lot going through them. So one very important one that is the majority of cases show is lethargy. So that is very unspecific and is due to the systemic disease, obviously. A lot of dogs present for lameness, and the simple explanation for that is that's very likely pain-related due to the osteolytic lesions. Then we can encounter bleeding, as we've seen in our case, and that might be for a variety of reasons. So I've listed four most common mechanisms here, one being that the platelet aggregation is inhibited by the immunoglobulins that the myeloma proteins have. They inhibit factor 3 release, and then the coagulation cascade cannot function. Certain clotting proteins may be adsorbed, and there might be an abnormal fibrin polymerization going on. In some cases, we can also find a decreased calcium. And then we know that looking at the coagulation cascade, that calcium is important for that to take place. So if calcium is not available, then the dog is likely to bleed as well. Probably the most important symptom to know about, because it is detrimental potentially, is the hyperviscosity syndrome, which can essentially is caused by the M components, so by the immunoglobulins that are produced, and it can cause end organ damage. So we can see renal problems, dogs can present neurologically with seizures. They can lead to cardiomyopathy and even to blindness due to retinal hemorrhage. Another clinical sign is PUPD, and that is in most cases associated with hypercalcemia, although in some cases we see a lot of kidney damage, and then the PUPD occurs because of that. So now, obviously, what we're very interested in is how do we now treat multiple myeloma? And for that, you've got quite a few options. I want to start here on this slide with the probably most widely known one, and it's probably also the treatment that is most commonly used, which is the combination of melphalan and prednisolone. Excuse me. So here I've given you the dosing scheme, how I generally start off with a dosing of melphalan and prednisolone. And if our patient responds very nicely throughout the coming weeks and months, then I tend to reduce the prednisolone dose first and stop that eventually as well whilst continuing the melphalan. So the owners definitely need to be prepared to give their dog lifelong medication. Side effects with melphalan is, of course, myelosuppression. That is not surprising, as obviously a chemotherapy agent, so it can be myelosuppressive. One thing I just wanted to mention here is that thrombocytopenia is probably the most common, and if it occurs, the most pronounced feature of myelosuppression in melphalan. And if myelosuppression occurs over time, and you see this as a recurrent finding, what we just need to remind ourselves is this may actually not be chemotherapy related anymore, because if we go back to the clinical signs and what we can see in the hematology of multiple myeloma patients, they can have cytopenias or even pancytopenias. So let's say you've stopped the melphalan or if you have reduced it and you still see that the dog has a cytopenia or two cytopenias, then what you probably need to do is repeat the bone marrow and check that the disease is not actually relapsed. In terms of monitoring, I tend to do a hematology and serum biochemistry weekly at the beginning until I'm happy that the dog is clinically better. And then I move on to every 2 weeks, probably for a month. And then once I'm happy, everything seems to have normalized, then I'll go to monthly or every 6 weeks monitoring. So what we also obviously want to assess is the response to treatment. And I've just given you some figures here to so you guys can be aware of what to look out for. So we want to generally see an improvement of clinical signs, meaning the pain should go away, obviously our tachycardia should go away, they should not be lethargic anymore. That can take up to a month for the owner to essentially get their normal dog back. So that's something to tell the owner as well, and for you not to panic, that this can take some time, especially with dogs that suffer from hyperviscosity. Another thing we look out for is a normalization of the hematology and biochem. So if there were any cytopenias, those should resolve. Equally, if we've got high total proteins, they should gradually normalize. And something I find very interesting and helpful in practice is if you have high total protein and you've proven there was proteinuria originally, then always check for a reduction in proteinuria first, because that is likely to resolve before your total protein in the blood is going to reduce. So that's a very helpful diagnostic tool. This last point here, that the radiographic improvement, so that your osteolytic lesions should vanish, that is something I don't generally recheck. Rescue treatments. So we've got a variety of rescue options here. Before I mention them in a bit more detail, I just want to say that if you have a dog that is suffering from very severe hyperviscosity, so maybe you've got a seizuring dog, high kidney values, you hear maybe a heart murmur, maybe is blind already, I probably would not start this one with melphalan-pred, because you've seen with the numbers before on the response slide that it can take days, weeks before we see the improvement. So for those guys, I'd probably want a faster acting agent, a more potent one as a first line. So I'll probably give this dog vincristine or cyclophosphamide, and then once I'm happy with the response, I then convert them to melphalan-pred. Coming back to those rescue treatments here, what I probably do in the first instance is I just exchange melphalan for a different alkylating agent. So, for example, cyclophosphamide or lomustine. If I do not see a response with those agents, I convert to a more intense either CHOP or COP protocol to rescue the disease. This is something I find very important as well, is that a lot of the time we're so focused on which chemo agent to use that we forget to treat maybe the dog's hypercalcemia or the dog's hyperviscosity syndrome in the beginning. The dog may also have kidney damage. Something number four is often forgotten, the immunological impairment of those animals. Because the body is so focused on making these nonsense immunoglobulins that the tumor tells the body to make, that it's actually not producing the normal healthy antibodies, and then those dogs can get infections. Another thing we need to focus on is obviously pain relief. Our dogs should get some pain medication with those osteolytic lesions, because in some cases they are very, very severe, and we need to pay attention to that. So that is just some these points in a bit more detail. So what can we do for hypercalcemia? So one very easy thing is fluids, to just put them on fluids. A lot of the time they come in as an emergency. You can't do all diagnostics in the evening or over the weekend. So that's very nice. Fluids very often used is saline, although you should be careful with leaving a dog on saline for longer than a day or two. So I tend to use plasmolide if available. In more severe cases, you can give them calcitonin. And then obviously, ideally, we treat the underlying disease. If you've taken all your samples that you need, so for example, your spleen, your liver aspirates, you've taken a bone marrow sample, then why not start them immediately on prednisolone? That is going to be very helpful for hypercalcemia. Hyperviscosity needs urgent treatment, and very often, even the vincristine I've mentioned here, is great, and those dogs will need immediate treatment with that. It's not going to help in the next hour or two. And if you have a dog that is blind, has a very high blood pressure, you might want to do something else to get those immunoglobulins out of the system. So if you have a dog like that, plasmapheresis is the way to go and what should be done as an emergency situation. Now I understand plasmapheresis is quite a process that might not be possible in first opinion practice, but I think it is very important to recognize those patients and then potentially refer them as an emergency, because they are seizuring, they're blind, they've got a high blood pressure, and you won't be able to control that in time, and those patients can die. Renal impairment is relatively easy to treat, so again, that's fluid therapy. And then for the immunologically impaired patient, you may need to give an antibiotic. Very often, or the most common infections that we encounter in multiple myeloma patients is either a UTI, and they need treatment for that, or some patients present for a pneumonia. And then last but not least, we've got pain that we need to alleviate. And a very nice medication aside from the medication you might normally use for pain is bisphosphonates that you could be using here. So last but not least, I just want to briefly talk about prognosis. What to expect, and a lot of you will probably compare that to lymphoma, because they're both, obviously plasma cell is going to be B cell. There is a B cell lymphoma, which generally has a prognosis of 10 to 12 months. And for a lot of owners, that's not enough. We do achieve a complete remission with melphalan prednisolone in about 40% of patients. So that's actually not a lot compared to lymphoma. So in lymphoma, we're expecting remission rates in over 90% of patients. The reason for that lower number is that myeloma generally compared to lymphoma is of lower grade nature. And chemo always needs rapidly dividing cells to attack it properly. And myeloma is generally or has a less mitotic rate than lymphoma, and therefore our complete remission rate looks lower. The partial remission is round about the same, up to 50%. And we also, when we look at the initial clinical signs, look at blood test results, patients with hypercalcemia, they might have renal damage or other end organ damage. Dogs with Benz-Jones proteinuria tend to have a negative prognosis because in order for those Benz-Jones proteins to get into the urine, you will have some form of kidney damage and bone lysis. Bone lysis is very important because if there are a lot of lesions, then pain is not just the only problem, but you might also get dogs in because they've fractured a vertebrae or they've fractured a leg even. That is possible. Compared to lymphoma, however, our median survival times are a lot better with chemotherapy. So this is the 18 months I've given you here is kind of a minimum. The majority of multiple myeloma patients, they live beyond 2 years. And that is with melphalan prednisolone. And if you can then imagine the dog relapses after those 2 years of treatment, and then you start a rescue protocol, this dog may still live for another 6 to 12 months. So that is quite favorable. In comparison, if these dogs just get prednisolone, they can live for up to about 6 months, some patients even longer, especially the ones that don't have severe clinical signs associated with the disease. Again, compared to lymphoma, that is a much better outcome. Without any treatment, it is generally fatal within a month, and that is usually due to the severe clinical signs. If they have hyperviscosity syndrome, they're seizuring, they have a high blood pressure, then probably those animals, they are likely to be euthanized earlier. Right. Do you guys have any questions on this topic now? Or do you want to ask something that you feel I haven't addressed in enough detail? So I'm just going to have a look if someone is asking a question. Right, I've got one coming in here. So I'm just going to read this out loud for everyone so that everyone can hear that. So the question is, what kind of pain medication I would use for those osteolytic lesions, and how I would generally administer the bisphosphonates. So as pain medication, I would never use an NSAID, obviously, because you're combining them, you can't combine them with prednisolone. I generally tend to use paracetamol if the symptoms aren't too bad, or combine it with gabapentin or tramadol. If I've got very severe and a lot of osteolytic lesions, then I very often go for amantadine, because amantadine is a very potent pain relief, especially with bony lesions. Regarding the bisphosphonates, I generally use pimidronate as a first line because it can be given as an IV infusion over 2 hours. That is usually repeated every 2 weeks, but I always start an oral bisphosphonate, so the zoledronate, as an oral medication at the same time, because bisphosphonates can take a few weeks to months to work properly. So you want, ideally, if the decision is to start bisphosphonates, to start them as early as possible for them to work. Right, let's have a look if anyone else has a question here. I think there's one. Yep, there's one more. So I'm just going to answer that quickly. The question is, I've mentioned cyclophosphamide, for example, as a rescue treatment option. So the question is just what dosing regime I use for cyclophosphamide and how I integrate this into the protocol. So obviously, the moment you find that your dog's relapsed and maybe the dog's off prednisolone at the time, the first thing I do is reintroduce the prednisolone. And then I want the cyclophosphamide to act very quickly. So I'll give a one-off dose of 250 mg per meter square of cyclophosphamide. And if that was successful, then I'll convert to 50 mg per meter square twice weekly. And I would try to maintain that for at least 1 or 2 months. And then I'll reduce that maybe to just once weekly. So I hope this answers all the questions. I can't see any more coming in now. Well, thank you all very much for joining for this seminar today. And I'll hope to see you again soon. Thank you. Bye bye.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Irina for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the Members' Area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.